This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. And I'm floating in a most peculiar way. And the stars look very different today.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 18 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us about today's topic.
Today, we're going to focus on the amazing history and contribution of the Hubble telescope, and it's approaching its 35th anniversary, orbiting our planet and still providing new insights into the universe. And that's without, Steve, that's without a single tune-up since the last space shuttle astronauts visited the telescope in 2009. But first, let's cover off a few of those updates that we like to dig up. And Steve, why don't you start us off?
Well, my update today, Tim, is with regard to the International Space Station, which is featured lately in the news, but we're not going to be talking about the so-called stranded astronauts. Now, we know that from the early days of space travel in the 1960s, virtually half of all astronauts and cosmonauts experienced degrees of space sickness and vertigo when they first entered microgravity. The acute symptoms range from the mild, with disorientation, dizziness, and queasiness, to the severe, with severe nausea and vomiting. Now, pre-flight training, the use of anti-nausea medications, and a few days in space usually alleviate this sickness. However, our update today is with regard to a variety of specific chronic health issues experienced by the crew aboard the space station during long durations. And we're talking about things such as rashes, unusual allergies, and various infections, including cold sores, fungal growths, and shingles.
That seems to be at odds with all the efforts that are taken to keep those spacecraft and the astronauts as clean as can be. Are we going to conclude here that, you know, the job they're doing has been half done? Where's the bleach, you know, when you need it?
And that was exactly what was going through my head, Tim. But counterintuitively, it seems the opposite is true. Now, it appears the space station is too clean and too sterile, and the lack of microbial diversity is contributing to those rashes and other infections. Now, on Earth, humans are constantly exposed to a wide variety of microbes, which help maintain a balanced immune system. However, on the ISS, the ultra-sterile environment limits exposure to beneficial and diverse microbes that are part of our healthy microbiome. This lack of microbial diversity tends to reduce astronauts' immunity over time. The reason being, their immune systems aren't challenged by exposure to everyday microbes. Studies have shown that dormant viruses, such as herpes simplex virus, which causes cold sores, and varicella zoster virus, responsible for shingles, can reactivate in space.
Well, let's say if you've ever had chickenpox, when seemingly cured, the virus actually remains dormant inside you, waiting for your immune system to become compromised or weakened, and then it surfaces again as a much more debilitating version called shingles.
Future missions might intentionally add beneficial bacteria to the ISS environment to restore microbial balance and prevent occurrences of those rashes and red bumpy lesions on the hands, arms, chest, back, and neck, and that happened to one astronaut after he was in space for 2 weeks, and this condition lasted for the next 200 days for him.
I've got an update too, Steve, and it's pertaining to our main topic today, which is space-based telescopes. There's actually a much smaller one that we rarely mention on the show, and it's called Euclid. It was launched in 2023 by the European Space Agency, and it focuses on dark energy and dark matter. Now, just recently, we heard that Euclid had discovered an incredible trove of dwarf galaxies. Listen to this, 2,674 new dwarf galaxies. And what, you may ask, is a dwarf galaxy? And just how many stars populate a dwarf galaxy? And most importantly, who cares about these wee cubby holes? Dwarf galaxies, just what are they? They're still pretty legit. They're compared to our own galaxy, the Milky Way. They have to have 10% or fewer of the number of stars that we have. And that actually means a few hundred to a few billion stars. It's quite common for these galaxies to orbit other galaxies. And in fact, I didn't know this, Steve, that we have two of them orbiting our own galaxy. And as to the importance, Euclid's study of dark matter and dark energy is important if you want to know things like why the universe is expanding or why stars at the periphery of a galaxy don't just get flung off into deep space. Part of that challenge is understanding the formation of galaxies, including how they were formed in the earliest eras after the Big Bang.
With regard to today's topic, we're going to talk about the older brother in this sort of research, the Hubble Space Telescope. And as you mentioned at the top, Tim, it's coming up on 35 years of service.
The venerable Hubble is still operational and it's still a very capable telescope. There's a great story here, and I was lucky enough, Steve, to get some insights by interviewing my friend Chris Gaynor. Chris has written several books on science, including one focused directly on the Hubble. I really enjoyed this discussion with Chris, and let's listen to more of what he shared. Chris, this is a radio show, so go ahead and blush while I brag about you. Chris has published 6 books, to my knowledge, on space exploration. The one with the most interest for us today is the book he wrote, commissioned by NASA to focus on the Hubble telescope. That one is entitled Not Yet Imagined, A Study of the Hubble Space Telescope Operations, and it's available, I might add, for free on the NASA website. So Chris has been a very active member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada. In fact, he was vice president. He was also teaching history at the University of Victoria and at CFB Esquimalt at the Royal Military College here in town. Chris, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have this chance to talk to you about the Hubble, which, of course, has been in service for an incredibly long time. And that's, I think, a part of our story today. But I wanted to start off by noting that the Hubble got a long gestation period. It was first funded in 1972 as part of the Large Observatories program. And in fact, it was first called the Large Space Telescope before being named after the great astronomer Edwin Hubble. There was a really long time from that first funding in 1972 to the launch of the telescope on board a shuttle in 1990. And Chris, I'm wondering about that. What took it so long to get from the first funding to space?
We're talking about a long time in terms of the Hubble's gestation period and also its operation period. In a month from now, we are going to be celebrating 35 years since it was launched. So that's a long time, particularly when you think that they were only thinking it would operate for 15 years. But getting back to your question, there were a number of events. First of all, they had to spend a few years actually getting Hubble approved, and it wasn't approved until 1977. And there was a number of very large technical challenges involved in building Hubble. For example, in the 1970s, this was before we had digital imaging. And back then, we were still using, photographic film. And there was questions about, well, how are we going to get the images back down to Earth and things like that? And fortunately, digital imaging came along. But there was a whole bunch of other challenges. One of them being the tragic loss of the Challenger space shuttle in 1986. And when the Challenger was lost, everything was put off. The sacrifice there was actually of great benefit to Hubble because, it had a number of problems when it was launched, as I think we'll talk about in a minute. But if it had been launched in 1986, I'm not sure. I think it would have had more problems, and I'm not sure whether they could have salvaged it.
It makes me remember that when the Apollo program was developed, it was understood, in fact, very much understood, that the science that was going to be needed was not yet available and would have to be worked on and, if you will, discovered. And what you're saying is that back in 72 and 77, they were planning ahead for this incredible telescope and hoping that they could generate the science needed to make it worthwhile. And I hadn't actually thought that one of the problems they hadn't foreseen was how do you get photographic film back to the Earth? And then that was became a non-issue. Do you remember any other kinds of general areas where the science just wasn't available? Was it optometry, or what kinds of challenges in that development did they have?
Actually, a big problem that they had in the early days of its operations, which would have been worse if they'd have launched in 1986, was with its solar panels. They designed these large solar panels, but when they launched it, they shook a lot. They had discovered during the period between 1986 and 1990 that the solar panels they had then would have deteriorated and probably failed fairly quickly. So they had actually put on better solar panels, but they still had problems. And the solar panels they have on Hubble today are actually quite different from the original ones, and even the ones they kind of had midway through its mission.
That sort of was part of the wonder of Hubble, that they understood that they would be able to go up and do work to repair and improve it, which, of course, is not something that is capable for the James Webb telescope. But let's go back to some of the Hubble basics. You know, why was it so special in its day? What was it going to be bringing to the table?
Hubble wasn't the first telescope to be launched into space, but the previous ones had been quite a bit smaller, just limited in their function. So Hubble is a great big telescope. It's as big as a school bus. The mirror is, 2.4 meters or 94 inches across, which is quite a bit. For example, Hubble is larger than any telescope you can find in Canada. So that was a big advance. And of course, it's above the atmosphere, observes in optical wavelengths, just the same we do with our own eyes, but it can also make observations to a limited extent in ultraviolet frequencies and infrared frequencies, which allows you to see more.
With an expanding universe, some galaxies are moving away from us to the point where they, if you will, go over the horizon of what we can actually see with any kind of telescope. And it makes you think that in some kind of fullness of time, the universe will, in a sense, look less populated as more and more galaxies slip over that horizon. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I'm not sure whether they would necessarily slip over our horizon, but they are moving away. The farther away they are, the faster they're moving away from us. That's kind of a concept that's a little hard to figure out. But one big discovery they made with Hubble was that rate at which the universe is expanding or moving away from us is actually accelerating, which is the opposite of what was expected.
That was a huge discovery, and I didn't know that Hubble had been responsible for that. And was that relatively recently that was, or is that early years?
Well, that actually involved a lot of work on a lot of telescopes, some of them on Earth by a lot of people, but it was kind of Hubble that put the icing on the cake. It really confirmed it. This basically was discovered in the 90s in Hubble's first decade. But you made a comment a minute ago about the universe, you know, everything becoming dimmer and darker and more distant from each other. And that's basically what the future of our universe looks like.
We tend to think of the robotic arms and all kinds of great achievements by Canadian astronomers and science and astronauts, you name it. And I'm wondering if you can speak to me about, you know, what involvement or use of the Hubble you can cite that's had a kind of Canadian content.
Some astronomers from Canada were quite involved in developing the Hubble. My friend John Hutchings, who spent his career based at Dominion Astrophysical Observatory here in Victoria, was the head of the Hubble Users Committee while they were setting it up. And then a number of Canadians have got time on observing time on Hubble. And part of the Hubble program involves fellowships for astronomers, which allow them to develop their careers. And some Canadians have obtained these fellowships. But where Canada wound up really helping Hubble was developing its archive, which is a really important part of it, because, you know, sometimes you want to make an observation with Hubble or James Webb, for that matter, and, you know, about 10 times as many people ask for time on those telescopes as is available. And as time goes on, we're finding out that you don't necessarily have to get time on Hubble because the observations you need have already been made, probably for another purpose. And all you need to do is go into the archive. Canadians were quite a key role in developing the archive for Hubble because, as I mentioned before, when Hubble was being developed, it was still kind of an analog world, and we've changed into the digital world. And so a lot of work needed to be developed to archive all of Hubble's data. So today you could just go on the internet and get data from the Hubble archive.
Isn't that data being kept here in Victoria at the observatory?
That's right. There are three places on Earth where you can obtain any of Hubble's data. One is the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore. The other is the European Telescope Archive in Madrid. And the third place is at the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory in Victoria, at the Canadian Astronomy Data Center. So the Canadians were helping the folks at the Space Telescope Science Institute develop their archive. And part of it was because we wanted access to the Hubble data. But at first, the Americans were kind of overwhelmed. So we hooked ourselves up to the Space Telescope Institute through what was soon to become known as the Internet. And so actually, the fact that we got the Internet as quickly as we did in the 80s and 90s has a lot to do with the Hubble Space Telescope.
Boy, that's a connection few people would know about, Chris. They launched the Hubble, and the first images to come back were, I don't know, blurry, I think is the word that is often used. And so here you've got this incredible investment of some 20 years of time, money, and effort. And the images that come back are not crisp, they're blurry. So what was that about?
It's a very complicated story, but it basically boils down to the fact that when they were creating this gigantic mirror that collects the light for Hubble, it was a time of tight money and budgets, So they decided to skimp on some testing of the mirror. Something wasn't quite right, so they said, let's slip in a little washer here. That's literally what it was, a 30-cent washer. And so all the results came out slightly skewed. So the mirror was ground to the precise wrong shape. And I mean, the level of precision is so high that, the difference between the proper shape and what it was like less than the width of a human hair. So the summer of 1990 was public relations cruise from hell. The Newsweek cover was, $1.5 billion blunder, because they'd already decided that they would be changing out the instruments in the shuttle every few years. They figured out a way to, in effect, fit it with contact lenses. So in 1993, the first servicing mission dealt with that problem. Within a year, it was like this symbol of failure had been completely forgotten and has ever since been seen as a symbol of, American success. And it's a redemption story.
The longevity of it is one of its most remarkable achievements that, you think about how long an iPhone lasts before it's, changed, or any kind of modern technology can quickly become, ancient history.
They've had these, I think it's five servicing missions from the shuttle. And the last one, which is now 16 years ago, the last time it was visited by the shuttle, but they did an especially good job on that, because if they'd have not flown that shuttle, Hubble would have conked out years ago. So that's also kind of an important part of the story, that they were able to look at kind of its weak points, the things that tend to fail. In Hubble, it's the gyroscopes, which kind of help keep it pointed in the right direction. On the last servicing mission in 2009, they put in a new set of gyroscopes. Now, there's six gyroscopes on board, and I think three sets of them have failed. But it's still going, and they've actually figured out how to run it on just one set. But it looks like we will probably have roughly another decade, and then its orbit will decay to the point where it would re-enter the atmosphere.
What were some of the achievements that stand out for you? I know you've studied this closely.
Taking an image that's known as the Hubble Deep Field. It's like kind of a cosmic borehole. there's kind of a process for getting time on the Hubble, but the director of the Space Telescope Institute has personal control of 10% of Hubble's time. The second director of the Institute was a guy named Bob Williams, and he was persuaded to aim Hubble at a very empty part of the universe, which is actually close to the Big Dipper, actually. But there was just like nothing there. You look there with a standard telescope here, you don't see anything. And what they did is that they took a long exposure, and I don't mean like 5 minutes. I mean like an entire week of just pointing at this spot in the universe and see what they got. And some very eminent astronomers said that Williams was nuts, basically, that this was not a good idea. You know, it's just going to be a waste of time. Well, the argument was, even if they didn't find anything, that would be kind of a statement about what was in the universe. Well, they made this exposure and found this, the image they got back was basically just chock full of galaxies way off in the distance. And it just created a sensation. So later on, it got better equipment put on board by the servicing mission. So it was able to look even deeper than that first deep field. And now Webb does it. And Webb is so much more powerful that it only takes a couple of hours to look as deep as it took Hubble a week to do.
That obviously changed our understanding of just how many galaxies there are in this universe of ours.
That's right. A lot of people, including myself, the first image that we downloaded from Hubble was the deep field. It was kind of an early star of the internet and helped create interest in the internet.
What you're saying is that for those inclined, such as yourself, it was akin to that Earthrise picture taken in 1968?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so for time's sake, I think I'd like to reference the fact that, you know, the James Webb has been launched, is operational, and it can do some science far better because it's got more modern technology. It's located at the distant from Earth in a static point that's going to last a long time. But we're talking about the Hubble. And as you said, it's got 10 more years of life in it. So it's still fully occupied. Does that pretty much describe things?
It has certain capabilities that are unique. You know, for example, James Webb is looking mainly in the infrared. It's an infrared telescope. It looks at those wavelengths. It looks at some infrared, but it also looks in the ultraviolet, which Webb can't do. And it also looks at things in optical wavelengths, which the Webb doesn't do either. And so, for example, Hubble and Webb 2 are also being used to look at the more distant planets in our own solar system. But before they came along, the only really good looks we had at Uranus and Neptune, for example, was when the Voyager spacecraft went by. And, you know, they were only in the area for a few hours. Now Hubble and Webb can do regular observations. And, of course, they're also being used to look at planets around other stars. This is a kind of an important change in astronomy. When Hubble was launched, the only planets that we knew existed were in our own solar system. Now, in the 1990s, they started discovering planets around other stars. Now, that wasn't Hubble that did that because of various technical reasons. But once they discovered these planets, then they could aim Hubble at those stars and those planets and make observations about the nature of those planets. And of course, the big search is on for a planet that's like our own planet right here on Earth. And Webb is involved in that, and they seem to be getting closer to that, but, you know, it's a bit of a needle in a haystack situation. So
the point is that in the 90s, when they discovered what is often now called an exoplanet, as you've described, we've gone from one of those to, what, thousands, if I'm not mistaken.
Thousands, that's right, yes.
And it's something that I think most people are surprised to hear that there are now catalogs, if you will, of exoplanets. So this hunt for more of them is doing incredibly well. And obviously, you pointed out that that's a role Hubble is continuing to play. Now, let's talk about, you know, where this ends, because at some point, 10 years from now or thereabouts, you've got this fairly substantial, massive telescope. I don't know just how much it weighs or whatever, but its orbit is going to decay. and something has to be done. Now, I've read that there was some thought of pushing it into a higher orbit, and mostly there was talk about how we could bring it down safely. So where do you think this is going to play out?
There's sort of a couple of things at play here. You know, what happens if the rest of its gyroscopes conk out, or just say there's just a general power failure? I mean, that could happen tomorrow morning, but probably not. Like I said, the probable thing is that we'll continue to operate for several more years, but eventually it will hit the top of our atmosphere, which will slow it down and it will re-enter. Now, the U.S. Congress has mandated that Hubble cannot be just left to have an uncontrolled reentry, and that NASA is supposed to send a vehicle up there to either give it a controlled reentry. Usually the so-called graveyard for these large spacecraft is in the South Pacific somewhere, far away from any islands or anything, or to boost it into a higher orbit. And that spacecraft has not been developed yet, but NASA is studying it right now. There are some people who actually want to refurbish Hubble again, but it's not so easy. I mean, the shuttle was the perfect craft to do those types of missions. And now, you know, we're using kind of old-fashioned space capsules like a Dragon or Starliner or what have you, or Soyuz, to get around, and they aren't so well suited. But one of the people who would like to, say, maybe kind of soup up or improve Dragon to refurbish Hubble is a guy named Jared Isaacman, who he's a buddy of Elon Musk's. And he's actually paid for a couple of private missions. He's gone into space twice on his own dime using SpaceX Dragon spacecraft. Isaacman has been appointed by President Trump to be the next administrator of NASA. So it just seems like everything to do with the U.S. government is in question right now. Most of the questions seem to be bad ones, but this may not be a bad one. We're just going to have to see what happens. So that may affect the fate of Hubble. But, you know, one has to say that the probability is that it will probably be go into a controlled reentry with some sort of spacecraft, just a robot spacecraft docking to it, or being knocked into a higher orbit. You know, because there's new telescopes coming along to follow Webb and things like that. The Webb telescope has a limited lifetime because, you know, Hubble uses its gyroscopes and momentum wheels to aim itself. But Webb actually uses thrusters, which require fuel, which is in limited supply. So the guess is that Webb will operate for about 20 years. But it's a million miles from us. You know, Hubble is only 300 or 400 miles up. Webb is four times as far away from us as the moon is. So when it just stops, it'll just stop.
We can see the ISS when it goes overhead. Is the Hubble telescope at all visible from Earth?
You have to go south because it's in an orbit that's tilted about 28 degrees to the equator. So like you have to be down in California or Florida or Mexico or closer to the equator.
So your book is available on the NASA website called Not Yet Imagined, A Study of the Hubble Space Telescope Operations. And I have to ask, you've got 6 books under your belt. I hope you're planning more.
Quite made up my mind. I've been writing some articles about things, including the relationship between Hubble and the Canadarm, and also fairly recently I wrote about the history of the Canadian Astronomy Data Center here and how Hubble helped Canada get the internet.
That's a great story, Chris. So listen, I want to thank you on behalf of Space Talks. Great to have you on the show, and wish you well.
Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure.
Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?